This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. My name is Matthew Jordan, and I'm an instructor in the history of science at McMaster University and a funk musician. I am very pleased today to be joined by Nicola Rehani, who is a Royal Society University Research Fellow and Professor in Evolution and Behavior at University College London. She is leader of the Social Evolution and Behavior Lab at UCL, and her research focuses on the evolution of social behavior in human and non-human species. We are here today to talk about the social instinct, how cooperation shaped the world, which is the first book you have written. So congratulations on writing your first major trade book. Nicola Rehani, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, thank you so much for the nice introduction and for the invite as well. And yeah, it's a nice moment to finally have finished and have it out there in the world.
Yeah, I'd love to start about the mere fact of writing a book, which is a daunting task for anyone, but especially when you are covering such a wide range of literature about evolution and cooperation in a variety of species, from the smallest molecular level to the biggest societal level. What prompted you to write this book?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it is, I guess, in some ways, I thought about it a bit like climbing a mountain. It's better to like just one step in front of the next and don't try to look too much at the summit, because it's a really, really daunting thing. And with the scope of the book that, like you said, that I wrote, it was quite daunting at the beginning to think about what could I put in and what would I leave out. But essentially, the book is about what cooperation is, and it's about the role that cooperation plays in the human success story. And that's very much the kind of story that I want to tell and that I want to give people. But it's also, it's not just about humans. It's also a book about all the other animals on Earth that cooperate in lots of different ways. So from things like suicidal ants to paternalistic burying beetles, and from diligent cleaner fish to the wonderful pied babblers of the Kalahari Desert. And then my aim in the book really is to showcase the enormous diversity of social behavior and of cooperation on Earth, and to give us a bit of an insight into what we, as an enormously social species, have in common with these other species that live a social life, and also, of course, what it is that sets us apart.
That makes a lot of sense, and it's quite the achievement that you get through in the book. And I will say it's wonderfully written and an absolute breeze to get through. Even though there's a lot of potentially complex topics in here, you really treat them all in a kind of systematic and thorough way. I guess from the level of the book itself, what is the kind of angle you were trying to go for, or what were you seeing that did not exist maybe in the literature that you were trying to accomplish with this book in particular?
So I think there is this sort of assumption, both sort of just among lay people, but also, as you say, like missing on the bookshelves in a way, that we as a species are selfish, that we're self-interested, that we're individualistic, and that also if you just take sort of a very narrow reading of even Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection, that what we would expect is things like nature, red in tooth and claw, survival of the fittest, every individual for themselves and things like this. And what I really want to show with the book, or the story I want to tell, is actually how important cooperation has been in creating life as we know it on Earth, and also in shaping our lives as humans. But the kind of deeper message, in a way, and maybe the one which is the sort of dark underbelly of the book in some sense, is this idea that yes, cooperation is probably far more prevalent and is in every sphere of our lives to an extent that perhaps we have overlooked or not appreciated. But also, cooperation is at its heart a means by which entities compete, and they are a means by which individuals or genes or cells improve their position in the world.
So there's kind of this dual nature of cooperation, which is simultaneously this working together, but at the same time, improving ourselves and getting ahead. And I guess that's the way, our bodies and our societies and our families and everything can happen at all, is because we're working together in some capacity. You have had a really interesting kind of research trajectory. You've worked, as you've mentioned, with animals, with humans, doing lab studies, doing field experiments. I'm wondering if you could speak about your educational journey and how you became interested in this subject and then becoming a professor of it and doing quite a lot of interesting research in many different domains.
Yeah, sure. So I now work in a psychology department, but I took a pretty strange path to getting there. So I trained originally as an evolutionary biologist. And in fact, for my PhD, I was doing really hardcore sort of like field biology, sort of traipsing around after these birds that I was studying, which are called pied babblers, and they live in the Kalahari Desert. And they are a very, very social species. So the babblers live in family groups, usually between 3 and about 14 individuals in a group. And they're unusual in that within every group, just one male and one female breeds, and everybody else in the group is relegated to be a subordinate helper. So their role in the group is to help the dominant pair to breed. So I worked on these birds for 3 or 4 years. And then I took a sort of a different step and started working on a completely different species, which is a species of fish called the blue streak cleaner wrasse, or the cleaner fish for short. And they're also an interesting species to study if you're interested in cooperation, because they cooperate with all the other fish that live on the reef by offering a parasite removal service to these other fish that live on the reef. And so the big two sort of strands to my research on non-humans have been research in family living species like babblers and some other species like mole rats and apostle birds, and then also looking at species that collaborate with non-family members, and in fact they collaborate with complete strangers, and those are the cleaner fish. And obviously we know that one of the things that makes humans sort of unique on Earth is that we do both of those things. So we collaborate intensely within our family units, but we also cooperate with people we don't know, people we might never meet, complete strangers. And so in some ways, these sort of different strands of the work that I've done on non-humans then dovetail together to help me understand the mechanisms that support cooperation in our own species and how they might be similar to what we see in other species, and also where we might start to see points of difference.
I'm so curious what doing research on, yeah, the pied babblers and the cleaner fish, for instance, what are you actually doing? What does that, I mean, are you sitting there with a camera? Are you taking notes? Like what does that actual research process look like?
So yeah, so they're quite different. So with the babblers, they're just wild. We worked on wild birds essentially, and they're free ranging. They're completely wild. And a big part of the research on babblers, or sort of the prelude to the research actually, was getting the birds to become accustomed to our presence and not to be frightened of us. And so we spent quite a long time habituating the birds, which is a really slow process. It's quite boring. You just have to basically sit really still, not be scary. But eventually it's amazing, because eventually the birds do stop being afraid of you. And in fact, we were able to, eventually we actually trained the birds with a special whistle that we would walk around their territory and we would give our whistle, and then the whole group would come to us in exchange for a mealworm each. And we could, you know, they're like better trained than my dog actually in some ways, but they would come to us, and then we could also we trained them after a time to jump onto a balance that we had so that we could weigh them and see who was in good condition, who's not in good condition. And because we were able to get so close to them, and these are birds that actually live most of their life on the ground, they can fly, but they forage on the ground, and they're pretty much on the ground all the time. And because we could get close to them, we could actually walk with the group, and we could observe at really, really close quarters all the different kinds of behaviors and social dilemmas and skirmishes and all kinds of things, like a soap opera in a way, that play out in the course of these birds' lives. And so that research was really quite observational, and it really involved just spending a lot of time getting to know these birds and getting to kind of understand what their life entailed, really.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I don't know. Do people start acting like, do the researchers start becoming like, I mean, you start getting yourself into the drama, you start absorbing their culture. I don't know. Or like it's like when people start looking like their dogs. I don't know if you start then looking like the birds you start to study, but.
I think you definitely have a sense in which if something, you know, a lot of the time nothing happens, because, you know, fundamentally their main thing they care about is foraging and getting food. So a lot of the time you're just twiddling your thumbs and nothing's really happening, but every now and then some major social event will happen in the group, and it usually was a really like newsflash moment when you came back to the shared farmhouse, like, oh my god, Tomboy did, you know, he evicted this bird from the group, or, you know, like, so if something major happened, it was always like a news item for us in our household at least.
Oh, I love that. No, it's amazing, because I guess it's hard to remember unless you're immersed in it like that, that the rich drama, you know, of life is not just, you know, it's hard enough getting outside of our own heads and realizing that every other human has a life as, you know, complex and interesting as yours. But then taking that one step further and realizing that, you know, birds and indeed all animals are living vast, like rich social lives. But I guess a meta question about this kind of research is, what can we learn about ourselves by studying animals like this? One can imagine a person saying, oh, this type of research is certainly interesting. You know, birds do this, fish do this, but that's, we are humans. We are different. And so where is the link? I mean, you know, we are all Darwinians, but what can we use about these animal species? How can that be helpful in making inferences about human cooperation or about the notion of, you know, being a social species in general?
I think one of the things that we learn by looking at other species is we kind of take ourselves off this pedestal of like thinking that we are, you know, unique in this respect or unique in that respect, because the more you get to know other species, the more you start to see instances where a behavior which we might have once thought was, you know, really a quintessentially human thing actually is seen in quite distinct species that we never would have expected. And one case where that happened to me in my research was concerning teaching. So basically, teaching is obviously something that as humans we're all familiar with, and we tend to think of it as occurring in really sort of like formalized settings you know, classroom, there's a teacher at the front, there's a bunch of kids in the room, and it's institutionalized and it's formalized. And obviously we don't see anything like that in other species, but that isn't to say that we don't see instances of active instruction that have evolved because of their ability to help another individual, a pupil, learn something. And that's exactly what we see in the babblers that I studied. So in the babblers, we see that being in the nest is a really dangerous time to be a babbler. So when they're babies in the nest, there's a, that if you're going to get eaten or killed by something, there's a, it's going to probably be while you're stuck in the nest, because you're defenseless, you're in one place, you're kind of, there's a chance that predators are going to find out where you are. And so babblers have a really rich repertoire of strategies that they use to try to help the nestlings to survive this really dangerous period of their life. And one of these strategies is to teach the nestlings to associate a specific call that the birds only ever give when they're visiting the nest with food delivery. So this call, we used to call it a purr call. It's like a guttural rolling sound. And when an adult bird arrives at the nest, when the nestlings are about 9 days old, they start giving this call. And at first, the chicks don't know what it means. They don't respond to it. But after a few days, they start to learn in a sort of Pavlovian manner that when I hear this noise, food arrives quite quickly afterwards. And they start to respond. If you play back that call to them through a speaker, even if there's no adults at the nest, they will, the three chicks will sort of reach up out of the nest, and you'll see all their heads poking out and lots of begging in anticipation of a food delivery. And what we discovered is that not only do adults teach the chicks to associate this call with the, with this specific meaning, like this means that food is about to arrive, they actually then use this call to kind of like white lies in a way. So they use the call even when they don't have any food in to offer to the chicks, to encourage the chicks to follow them in situations where it would be dangerous to not follow. So for example, if there's a predator or if they need to go to the evening roost tree or something like that, they'll quite often give this call that the chicks think, hey, I've got food. And in fact, they haven't got food, but it encourages the chicks to follow them because they've learned that this association between the call and food. And in that way, the babblers teach their offspring something useful. They teach them this, the meaning of this call, and help to keep them alive.
I'm curious. I remember reading about, you know, when E.O. Wilson first wrote the book Sociobiology and gave talks on the subject, talking about ants, what we can learn about, you know, social cooperative behavior from ants. He was like, people threw tomatoes at him, and it was, you know, they called him, they called him nasty names because we are humans, you know, chief of, you know, kings and queens of the animal kingdom. Do you think that that sense is still there, or has, I don't know, the public at large or the research community more gotten used to this idea that, you know, no species is, you know, superior or inferior to any other. We are all just kind of doing our best in our own ecological niche and, you know, behaving in the way, using the tools that natural selection gave us to reproduce and socialize and survive.
I think that there is now an awareness that it's sort of, I think now that we, as a community, that the question of like, are humans unique is sort of seen as being somewhat an ironic question, although people do still continue to ask it. And it's clear that in some respects, we are unique. But I think if you look at the field as a whole, and even this sort of like now, you know, this sort of newfound self-awareness of like, we're just another species and we shouldn't be parochial about human abilities compared to the abilities of other species. I think it's perhaps almost like inevitable in some ways that our benchmarks for cognition and behavior, our starting point for saying like, here's an interesting thing, where do we see it in nature, is always going to be in our own species, because it's just so hard for us to look to other species and be like, hey, that species is amazing at X. I wonder if humans are very good at that. I just don't think that's often the starting point for people. I think more often the starting point is humans seem to be really good at doing this thing. What are the, can any other species do it, or are we the only ones? And so I think there's kind of like quite a nuanced answer to that question in a way, because I think there we have the self-awareness, but in some ways it's really hard for us to get away from that human bias, because we are humans. And so it's hard for us to not think about cognition and behavior in very human terms, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. And I certainly hold that bias myself. And to that point, would like to turn to humans and talk about some of the main forms of cooperation and social group behavior that we engage in. And I guess one that you speak about at length is the family. And so in human societies, you know, we have a method of reproduction where two people need to pair up and have children and raise children, and many different people contribute to the rearing of those offspring, and families tend to stick together and support their children. But this, as you discuss, you know, this is not necessarily, you know, the natural order of things. There are many different ways that species can kind of propagate themselves and reproduce. But we do it in this way. So what is the reason for the way that, well, first of all, is there one single definition of the human family as an entity? And why, if there is some, you know, human universal there, why is that the way that we've evolved to do things?
So I think this is a really interesting question. And this obviously marks a point of difference between us and all of the other great apes, is that if you take a chimpanzee, for example, a chimpanzee infant will be raised by its mother only and will have very, very little involvement from a father or from any other family member, really. And when we look at the situation in humans, what we see is something really, really different, which is that many family members are involved in raising offspring. And it isn't just the mother, but it's also obviously the father, although that varies. The importance of paternal care and the involvement of fathers in the raising of offspring varies quite broadly across human societies, but fathers do generally help to raise their offspring. But also we have non-reproductive helpers in human societies, a bit like the babblers that I described. And those can be either the older children, the older siblings that are at home and that help to raise their younger siblings. But we also have permanently sterile physiological helpers that we call grandmothers. And they are also a helper morph, if you like, in human societies, and have been hugely important in the evolution of human society. And I think that one thing that is sort of really easy to overlook, in particular for people who are listening to this, who might be living in Western industrialized societies, mm-hmm. that emphasize the kind of nuclear family as the de facto organization, or the way that family is organized, is that the nuclear family is a massive outlier, both if we can think about either in broad cross-cultural perspective, but also if we look back at the history of our species over time, the nuclear family is an anomaly, essentially. And how humans would have lived for most of our life on Earth would have been in much bigger family groups, where the emphasis on parental care, or the responsibility for parental care, wasn't falling primarily to the mother, but was done by many individuals, and children were raised by many individuals within a family. And I think that's one of the things that I think, in some ways, hopefully for some people who will read the book or listen to the podcast, there is a sort of, I find that an empowering realization as a mother myself, that like, it's not only on me to kind of make sure that my children turn out okay, and that I'm their primary sort of source of emotional support and care, and like that that kind of is a bit of a Western cultural ideology rather than a biological imperative.
Right. Yeah, no, that makes a great deal of sense. And I've felt that certainly among some of my friends as well. This I have found as I move into my, you know, late 20s, that my friends are coupling up, nuclearizing, as it were, so, you know, getting their own places, moving in together and starting these, you know, eventually starting families. And I know other people who are kind of living in a more group together, you know, multi-story house, living all together in a kind of more collective way. And that kind of makes more intuitive sense to me. This idea that, you know, why should just, you know, raising a child is a pretty serious endeavor. And the idea that, you know, only two people should be the immediate caregivers doesn't strike me as making sense, which in reading the book and, you know, learning about how weird, so to speak, Western educated, industrialized, rich, democratic societies are so different than, you know, tens of thousands of years of human history where we did it, where we did this differently. But I guess my bigger question is, why do humans in particular, so in contrast to the other apes you were describing, who the children are just raised by the mother with little involvement from other family members, why did we evolve this mechanism where so many people contribute to helping us grow?
Well, if we look at the environments in which early humans lived, they were, the best word to describe them in some way is difficult. And so the environments that characterize the sort of formative periods of human evolution were really tough. Like, it would have been hard to eke out an existence. Food was pretty hard to come by. It was sparsely distributed in the environment. There would have been a reasonable threat of predation, living on sort of open savannas with the full complement of megafauna and sort of giant versions of some of the species that we know about today. And so humans needed one another to survive. And the only reason we could survive in those environments is because we were so cooperative. And if you couple that with the fact that human infants are also born quite sort of underdeveloped is one word to describe it. Mm. So for a human to be born with the same sort of physical and bodily ability as a chimpanzee, they would have to probably be born around 18 months later than they actually are born. But in fact, there's an obvious sort of there's a difficulty with that, which is the gap in the maternal pelvic floor, or the pelvic basically the pelvic gap that the head of the infant has to fit through of the mother is limited, and there's a human infant with a head that was larger than the head that they normally have at 9 months old would have a really hard time making its way out of this hole, essentially. And already at 9 months old, it's already kind of hard enough, I can tell you from experience. So, essentially we give birth to these undercooked infants that need, in an environment where food is hard to come by, where it's difficult to survive anyway, and where we actually need help in raising these infants into childhood and beyond. And so I think it's a real mix of things, but basically I think it's this combination of inhabiting difficult environments, needing a nutrient-rich diet, a much more nutrient-rich diet than the other great apes eat usually, and also having these really, really costly infants are three sort of key things that can help us to understand why we see such an emphasis on family life and cooperation in humans, in particular in the context of childcare, that we don't see in, say, chimpanzees or gorillas.
Hmm. Yeah, you see the footage of like those, I don't know, birds who emerge from a shell, and they just kind of start venturing out into the water, and it's like, wow, you just knew what to do right away, and human babies are kind of slimy and confused and don't really know what's going on for the first year of life. And I guess what you're describing is like a trade-off between us having, you know, big brains and big bodies, but also being able to, you know, mothers being able to give birth in a way that is actually, you know, safe and doesn't, you know, break the body. So no, that's really interesting. And so we have these family structures as you've described. Actually, one interesting piece of research that you alluded to is about grandmothers in particular. I'm wondering if you could go into a bit more detail about that specifically, because you speak in the book about the kind of evolutionary basis for menopause, which is the explanation for, you know, kind of this helpful grandmother hypothesis in the family. If you could speak a bit more about that.
Sure. So menopause is a bit of an evolutionary puzzle, because what we see when a woman hits menopause is that she is switching off her ability to reproduce. And so in some ways you think she might be becoming an evolutionary dead end. And obviously I'm not implying that menopause is something that individuals choose to do or don't choose to do. But when we use language, we can use language like this to just kind of as a helpful shortcut for understanding evolutionary decisions that get taken, that not psychological ones. So when we think about menopause, we might say, well, why would females ever agree? And I mean agree in sort of scare quotes here. Why would females ever agree to switch off their reproduction so long before they die? Because in doing that, they kind of render themselves an evolutionary dead end. And it would seem to be something that would be selected against, not selected for. And if we look at the number of follicles that human females have, human females are born with all the follicles that they'll ever have in situ, and follicles develop into eggs. And what we see with the store of follicles that human females have is that they decline at a pretty steady rate throughout life. But when a woman hits the age of about late 30s to early 40s, that steady decline suddenly drops off a cliff, and the number of follicles drops quite markedly. And at about the age of 50, females will undergo this physiological transition, which is the menopause, where they no longer have enough follicles to sustain regular menstrual cycles. And the question is, well, why does that follicle store drop off a cliff at that point? Because if it didn't do that, you would in principle have enough of them, the average female would have enough of them to continue breeding until she was in maybe her 60s or 70s. So it's something that warrants an explanation. It's something that happens that we, you know, we can ask from an evolutionary perspective why it happens. And to understand it, it helps to understand some of the conflicts that might have been playing out between reproductive females in ancestral human societies. So if we go like kind of wind back the evolutionary clock and wind ourselves back to the time when humans were living in foraging societies and living in these extended family groups, what our best guess about this period of time is that when females reached reproductive age, when they were ready to start reproducing, they tended to leave their home environment with their own family and their own relatives, and they would tend to disperse or move to live with the family of the male partner that they would be having children with. So that's we don't know that for sure, but all our best evidence suggests that that is the case. And that's important for the following reasons. So you have the young females who are moving to live with their husband, and I use that term very loosely. There was no institution of marriage, obviously, but they're moving to live with their male partner and also the male partner's female relatives in a new location. When you have multiple females that try to have babies at the same time, if you already live in a difficult environment where food is scarce and it's hard enough to raise one offspring at a time, let alone, you know, two or three, you can get competition between females over who gets to breed And essentially here, the competition that we're interested in is competition between the younger females and their mothers-in-law, the mother of their male partner. So if you think about this conflict, there's a conflict between the two females over who gets to breed. If they both breed, all the children will suffer because there's not enough food. And so it's better if just one female breeds, but it's kind of a conflict about who's going to get to do that. And the way that conflict is resolved is due to what we call a relatedness asymmetry between those two females. And to put it very simply, the mother-in-law has a vested interest in any offspring that are produced by the younger female because she's related to them via her son, whereas the younger female has no vested interest whatsoever in any offspring that are produced by the older female because she's not related to, she won't be related to those offspring, not genetically. And that relatedness asymmetry actually weakens the mother-in-law's hand, and it can select for this physiological transition whereby the mother-in-law actually concedes in a way in the battle. She switches off her reproduction. She doesn't compete with the younger female, and she becomes, she has the menopause. She becomes a sterile individual. And at that point, she can still help to increase her fitness, by which I mean she can help to the chance of copies of her genes finding their way into subsequent generation by helping to raise her grand offspring, the grandchildren. And that help and the help, the way that that help benefits the younger generation, the grandchildren, can actually select then for this increased lifespan that we see in humans, where females don't just undergo the menopause and then die, as you might expect. If there was, you know, if they really were an evolutionary dead end, there would be no evolutionary selection pressure to keep them alive beyond this point. But there is a selection pressure to keep them alive, and it's to do with the benefits that can be accrued through helping to raise grandchildren.
Wow. Yeah, that is fascinating bit of, you know, evolutionary thinking. It's like a puzzle that you have to reason backwards from the current state of affairs to get back to kind of the history that would have gotten us to this point. But I guess it's all premised on this idea that you can propagate your own, genetic endowment, not just through having children of your own, but through supporting people who are related to you. And maybe you could say a bit about that kind of gene level view of thinking about reproductive fitness, and why, for instance, it's reproductively beneficial for someone to, you know, help raise their grandchild or even their niece or nephew, even if that is not, you know, their direct progeny.
Sure. So this is an idea that was obviously really sort of championed by Richard Dawkins in when he wrote The Selfish Gene. But essentially, to paraphrase what, you know, those ideas, a gene that's present in my body doesn't really care how it finds its way into the next generation. And all genes are selfish or self-interested, if you want a less loaded term, and in that they are driven to try to find their way into subsequent generations. But they don't really care how they do it. And so a gene that's present in my body, in principle, can find its way into the next generation via my own offspring or via of what we call my personal fitness and my personal reproductive success. But it can also find its way into subsequent generations via offspring that, say, my brother has or my sister has. And it can be sometimes, under some evolutionary scenarios, beneficial for individuals to actually pause or entirely switch off their own personal reproduction in order to focus on helping family members to produce offspring instead. And the most famous example of that would be where we see that sort of taken to the extreme, if you like, is in species of social insects like ants and bees, where you have some individuals that are born as sterile worker castes whose only job is to serve the queen and help her to lay as many eggs as she possibly can and to raise those eggs and to make new offspring.
I noticed that the book cover, at least my version of the book cover, I don't know if this is the North American one versus the UK one, is of bees are on the cover. Is that, was that the rationale, or do you have any say over what goes over on the cover of the book?
I think I could have vetoed it. I mean, I think the bees, I do like the cover, but in the beginning I was a bit like, I thought like, okay, bees, it's like, it seemed a bit obvious to me, but yes. I think, you know, bees are like, I don't know, I think it's also a hard sell to kind of, you know, put something like a mole rat on there because they're so ugly, and it's not, you know, people aren't going to pick up a book with this animal that looks like a penis with teeth on the front of it. So I think, you know, in a way, bees, people like bees, and, you know, it's fine, basically.
I don't know if that's necessarily true. I think toothy penis sells. I think that's, I don't know, it's intriguing anyway, but yeah. So I'd love if we can move now. We've been speaking about the family. We've been speaking about, you know, genetic relationships. We spoke a lot about other animal species. But now I'd love to turn to this idea of helping people, cooperation among people you are not related to, or indeed people you don't know. So, I mean, the question I have here is, why would a person ever help a stranger?
Yeah, so it's a good question, and it's not, this is kind of like, there's not just one answer to it, but, you know, obviously this is something that humans do all the time, and it's a massively important part of our ecological success. You know, it's the thing that has helped us to scale up, not from just living in these small family groups to actually living in huge, large-scale societies that many of us nowadays live in. And I think there are a number of things that humans have done and have changed about our interactions with other people that have helped this to happen. So one thing that humans seem to care about a lot is our reputation. And there's really good evidence that a concern for how you appear to other people is really important in predicting cooperative behavior. And so there's one sort of big strand to the bow, if you like, of why humans are cooperative. Another big reason why humans might cooperate with other individuals to whom they're not related is this theme of interdependence, whereby we come to have a stake in one another's fitness and well-being, and such that it kind of is in our interest to help these individuals. And, you know, we see, although I think we haven't quite realized it really at the moment, but like the COVID situation has really emphasized how just how interdependent we really are on each other, even with people we don't know and we might never have met. So yeah, we have reputation, interdependence. The threat of punishment is another big tool in that toolbox of scaling up cooperation to this larger scale that we see in humans. And then finally, another big tool, if you like, is our ability to devise what we call institutions, which are basically just the shared norms and rules of interactions that we agree upon that form part of our culture, that help us to engineer cooperation in situations where we might otherwise be stuck in a sort of less cooperative setting.
Hmm. Wow, I have a lot of questions just about the things we were just discussing. So maybe where to start? I'll start with this idea of reciprocity, which is, you know, there's one, I guess intuitively it makes sense that, you know, if you help other people, even if they're not related to you, then one day when you need help, they might, you know, help you back. But humans do quite a bit of that. You know, we help our neighbors and we help our friends, but we also help people who we might never even see, you know, total strangers. We donate to charity to help people whose, you know, success or failure or health will really have no measurable effect on our own life success, except, well, maybe it does reputationally or something else. So I don't know, maybe you could say a bit about, yeah, why not just helping people we're not directly related to, but people we might never even see in the first place.
Yeah, so I think reciprocity is kind of part of the story, but I think there's also cases where reciprocity can really undermine sort of cooperation, and especially if you use reciprocity in the context of sort of important relationships. For example, if you go out with your friend and then, you know, you go for a beer and then your friend turns around and says, oh, hey, by the way, it's your turn to buy the beer today because I bought it last time. That kind of strikes us as being a bit iffy, because reciprocity is, we don't expect reciprocity in that scenario. And so there is this, in one sense, we can understand helping behavior in terms of interdependence. And that would help us to understand, in particular, helping behavior among, say, like friends and known interaction partners. But then you're right that we then also see in humans this tendency to help individuals that we don't even know, that we've never met, that we might never meet. And giving to charity is, yeah, like a really good example of that. And I think if we want to understand why people do that, there are two kinds of answer you can give to that why question. And it's important that we don't conflate them, because often when people give evolutionary answers to that question, when they show how giving to charity or being pro-social could be ultimately in the altruist's long-term interest, sometimes you get accused of sort of taking the altruism out of altruism. And, you know, people will say, well, I like to give to charity because I like giving to charity, or because I'm a good person and things like this. And so I just want to quickly dispel this idea that there's a kind of conflict between those levels of explanation. So when we ask why a person, for example, gives to charity, we can give an answer which is what we call approximate level answer, which is concerned basically with the immediate motives or the psychological motives that underpin that helping behavior. Or we can give an ultimate level answer, which is more like the evolutionary answer that I just spoke about, understanding how helping behavior could ultimately have been favored by selection. And so if we just think about those proximate, the motivational answers for now, we know that when people help others, for example, by giving to charity, it often feels really good to do that. And so there are subjective reward mechanisms in the brain, and you can study them. If you put people in an fMRI scanner and have them do nice things for other people, you see that all these reward centers that are associated with other rewarding things like having sex and eating cake and recreational drugs, those same reward centers are also active when we are given the chance to behave pro-socially. And there's a whole suite of really cool studies showing that being helpful is often a purely psychologically altruistic thing that's done out of a concern for the beneficiary, and that is subjectively rewarding to do. So if we park those explanations for a minute and say, okay, yes, we understand that people help because they care about the beneficiary. It feels good to help. People can be genuinely psychologically altruistic. But we can also then say, okay, fine. Why have we got a brain that is wired in a way that makes us enjoy doing something that actually on the face of it is costly? Why do we have a brain that makes us enjoy giving away resources to people that we've never met and that we might never meet, and where there's no potential for reciprocity and where we're not interdependent? And so then we're starting to get into the realm of these evolutionary level answers as to why it mm-hmm. might ever be good or beneficial for an individual to be pro-social or to appear to be pro-social. And one main reason why that can be the case is because there are obviously reputation benefits that go hand in hand with appearing to be pro-social. And when individuals gain these reputation benefits, they quite often benefit from getting access to better partners, getting better social network positions, being more likely to be helped themselves when they're in need of help at some point in the future. And so there are a whole host of reasons why gaining a reputation as being a pro-social individual could yield downstream benefits to the person But I just really want to emphasize that what we're not saying is that the only reason people do things is because they're expecting reputation benefits, because those quite often the proximate reason you do something and the reason why it might have an evolutionary advantage are completely separated from one another. And you might not ever be aware of the evolutionary advantage of why you do one thing or another.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. I guess there's a similarity to, you know, eating sugary foods. Like the reason you do it is because it tastes good. But the real reason, you know, the reason that it tastes good is because, you know, in some ancestral environment, there was not access to a lot of sugary food. So, you know, we evolved a mechanism where, you know, apples or whatever tasted extra good because,
example where now it's like a mismatch actually between, the availability of sugary foods is now, you know, too much in a way, but we have this mechanism that makes us still think it's really delicious and maybe eat too much of it sometimes.
Yeah. Another factor that you brought up, in addition to this idea of, reputation, reciprocity, all these kinds of altruism questions, is this idea of institutions. Humans are able to cooperate and form governments and build pyramids and create, you know, these kind of supervening structures over society and pass on norms to the next generation in a way that, frankly, I don't know. I find if I think about it too much, I get emotional about it. It's like, the fact that we can pass on these traditions and form these institutions, even the institution of science itself, has its own kind of culture that gets passed on through the generations. Yeah, I'm wondering, is this a phenomenon that is unique to humans? This level of collective, cooperative, norms and traditions that get passed on, and if so, why? You know, what has been the advantage of this incredible capacity for institution building?
Sorry, you're cutting out a little bit, but was your question basically what is the advantage of being able to devise and enforce institutions?
Yeah, that's right. And my first question was, is this a uniquely human capability? Oh, right, okay. And then secondarily, what was the evolutionary, cause of this, if so?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right that it is an evolutionarily sort of a one-off thing. It's only humans that are able to do this. And it gives us the possibility to find our way out of social dilemmas, essentially. So a social dilemma is any situation where it would be best if we could agree to cooperate, but individuals face a individual temptation to defect. And because individuals succumb to that temptation to defect, we can end up in a really worst case scenario where everyone defects, even though that's actually worse than if everyone could agree to cooperate. So we end up in the kind of classic thing to think about is the tragedy of the commons. And institutions offer us a way out of situations like that. And I think it's so much a fundamental part of the human cognitive toolkit that we even see it in young infants or children, I should say, really. But there's some really great experiments involving children where the children are brought to the experiment and they have a train set, and they have this incentive that they have to get their train to go round the track a certain way, but then at some point the train has to go over a bridge, and they can only one train can go over the bridge in one direction at a time. And so one child's trying to send his train that, you know, from left to right, and then the other child's trying to send his train from right to left. And the question here is, how do you resolve this kind of social dilemma where you both want to do something to maximize your own gains in the experiment, but there's a conflict because if the partner is kind of sending his train over the bridge, you can't send your train over the bridge. And children resolve this social dilemma using a very sort of intuitive rule, which is that they invent in the context of the game turn taking. And so they, in a situation like this, kids will basically very quickly coalesce without any sort of input from the experimenter on the solution of, okay, well, I'll go, it'll be my turn this time, and then it'll be your turn next time, and then it'll be my turn again, and then it'll be your turn again. And that's a kind of really rudimentary kind of institution for solving what would otherwise be an intractable social dilemma that could only be solved through, you know, force or fighting, or where one individual would end up always winning the encounter and the other one would end up not really getting anything. And we just don't really see evidence in other species and or in the other great apes of this ability to invent these new rules and agree upon these new rules for how we think, you know, how we should solve these kinds of dilemmas. And so I think that's sort of a really nice example, but we see lots of obviously much more complex examples of institution design in societies. But that's just one sort of really easy one to get your head around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The thing that really kind of twists my brain when I think about it is just this human capacity to kind of buy into collective fictions. You know, I think about the law or the government, like these are just kind of societal structures that we have just all bought into as being true because we have these like social malleable brains that are able to, you know, kind of understand rules and intuit norms. And then you just participate in this society where everyone's kind of bought into this, you know, fiction of the Supreme Court or whatever, like these five people in robes, like we are then able to kind of act en masse in a coordinated way, according to kind of the dictates of certain groups of people. So it's amazing that kind of this base level, you know, children playing games, you know, this rule kind of creation can extend all the way up to kind of the, you know, the forces that keep the society afloat.
Yeah, for sure. And like you also see, you know, on that point about these collective fictions, I mean, money in a way, yeah, the use of money is what is like a hugely helpful collective fiction that allows us to, you know, to scale up trade and exchange and to not only rely on trading things that can be used immediately, like food, but to kind of store the surpluses of trade in a form that doesn't decay over time, money. But you also see that when this kind of this collective belief in an institution like this, or this collective agreement about this institution, starts to fail, then you see that things like, you know, the collapse of currencies and things like that. So I think it's on the one hand, it's like this is a huge human superpower, but on the other hand, it's you also kind of get this sense of like that these things can be fragile and they are subject to sort of stochastic forces and tipping points and things like that.
Right. In our last few minutes, I'd love to speak about what the current pandemic, COVID-19, has taught us about cooperation. Obviously, you know, the reason pandemics can happen is because we are a species that likes being in close contact with each other, and we fly all around the world, and we want to be with people, and we want to, you know, be in physical contact, proximity with other people. And that's a great way for pathogens to spread. And so to reduce the spread, we have to kind of all isolate in ways. But, you know, we have the internet, we have phones, we have means of cooperating in other ways. So I'm just curious if you have any examples of, yeah, key lessons that kind of, I'm sure this pandemic happened as you were writing your book. And I don't know if you felt like some of your theses were kind of bolstered or supported by the pandemic, or from an evolutionary perspective, what your kind of takeaways are from the last, you know, year and a half.
I think there's a few things. So I think one of the things that the pandemic has done has exposed the myth of the Western nuclear family. And in particular, it's done that because the only way that the Western nuclear family could function and we could manage to raise these offspring in the absence of help from any other family members really was because we outsource childcare to institutions like schools and nurseries, and you know, some of us are lucky enough to have help from grandparents and stuff. And when those support networks are ripped away in the way that they were for so many parents during the pandemic, it becomes really obvious that like we are a species that evolved to have help raising offspring, and like doing it on your own is really something quite difficult and something which we're not, I don't think, evolutionarily prepared for. So that's one sort of takeaway that I think has been interesting from an academic point of view, although on a personal level, I don't ever want to repeat the experience. I think another thing that the pandemic has shown us, or should have shown us, although it remains to be seen whether we learn the lesson or not, is the extent to which we really are interdependent, not just with people that we encounter in our everyday lives and our friends and family, but with people that we might never meet and that live in different countries. And the way that other individuals' lives, and in this case, their susceptibility to an infectious disease, can start to impinge on you and your life, I think is really stark. And I think we still haven't fully grappled with that, or perhaps realized that, when it comes to thinking about how vaccines ought to be distributed and whether, you know, nations that have vaccines ought to keep them for themselves, or whether it is actually the right thing to do, not just for moral reasons, but for actually self-interested reasons, to distribute these vaccines as widely as possible, because we are interdependent in this situation. And we're not out of this situation of the pandemic until we're all out of it. And so I think that that interdependence angle is also something quite interesting to think about. The final lesson that I think we can take from this pandemic is this idea of thinking about what happens when we face a collective threat, and do we become more cooperative or do we become more self-interested? And I think that the answer to the question is actually a bit of both. So mm-hmm. I think what we saw in the wake of the pandemic, and what we saw in many different countries, was a massive scaling up of hyper-local cooperation. So what we saw in a lot of places was people forming mutual aid groups within their neighborhoods, helping, you know, maybe talking to their neighbors for the first time, helping people who live nearby. And we saw there was lots and lots of really heartwarming examples of quite local cooperation. But when we actually look more broadly at did we just become sort of more cooperative overall, I think the picture is actually much more mixed. And I think when you look at broader scale cooperation, what we actually saw is probably that dwindling to some extent, or at least not increasing. So we saw people, you know, everyday people just panic buying pasta and toilet roll, you know, in some sense competing over these limited resources with other people that were also trying to get hold of them. When you look at competition between the states of the United States of America, or even between nation states, there wasn't really that much help that was being offered, either in the early days or now with access to vaccines, you know, with things like ventilators and PPE. It was much more the case that these sort of larger scale entities were kind of keeping what they had for themselves and not necessarily offering those kind of vital resources more broadly to others that needed them. And so I think what we see in the wake of a pandemic is that you see this kind of hyper local cooperation that doesn't really permeate out to broader levels of cooperation.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, once you start looking, I read another book, Apollo's Arrow by Nicholas Christakis, who, I mean, that's a book specifically about COVID, but it had a similar kind of angle where we can, so many features of human social experience are just brought into stark relief by kind of this kind of extreme environment where people are forced to lock down or quarantine or be separated from loved ones, or in some cases get closer to loved ones. And we kind of have to take stock of okay, what are we doing? We kind of have an anthropological view of our own, goings on when it's all disrupted in that way, right? Making the familiar strange, I guess. That is all the time, unfortunately, that we have. I looked away and then I looked back at the clock. We've been talking for an hour. Incredible. So, but, and yet we've barely scratched the surface, I would say. I mean, your book has kind of four distinct parts. You talk about kind of peeling the onion layers. I didn't explain that metaphor right. But, from the individual to the family to the society. I think most of this conversation is kind of only focused on the latter half of the book, if that. And so we have barely scratched the surface. So for anyone listening to this, if the topics we've discussed today are of interest to you, I would highly recommend you pick up a copy of The Social Instinct. Do you have any parting thoughts, or I'm curious what you are working on now, or if you are still looking into different kinds of cooperation in your research?
We're still, I'm mainly working on punishment at the moment, and also some papers on reputation, but it's been a pretty tough year as far as research has gone, because obviously having two young kids at home for a lot of it has stymied quite a bit of the research that I've been doing. But I'm thinking about another book, but only in sort of quite abstract terms at the moment. I'm not quite sure if I'm ready to go there again yet. But yeah, I hope people enjoy the book, and it's been a real pleasure talking to you.
You as well. The book is The Social Instinct by Nicola Rehani. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you, Matthew.